Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for playing us in from commercial, Zombie Zach. What a break that was, huh?
Somewhere beyond the sea, there lies a D and an E.
That's for you alphabet fans out there. Look it up sometime. So let me hear you in the chief seats, folks. We are back. Funky Werepig 2010. This is the one that kicks off a whole new year for us. And it was a nice break, nice fun little break. We got to take a breather and touch the toes and do all the ho-ho-hos and all that kind of stuff. So that was fun. That was a lot of fun. Hope you guys had a good holiday and a good, safe new year. Jezzy.
Yes, Greg.
You're awake and with us. This is so cool. Is this going to be like a New Year's resolution for you?
That or alcoholism, one or the other.
Everybody needs a hobby, man. Everybody needs a hobby. And speaking of which, yesterday was a special day for you, wasn't it?
It was a Saturday.
It was a Saturday. It was a birthday kind of Saturday for you.
Well, you get them every year.
Yeah, well, they do happen every year. That's the cool thing about birthdays. They just seem to wander around. But don't downplay it. Don't downplay it. This was your special day. This was very cool. As a matter of fact, if I would have thought about it for your birthday present, I wouldn't have sang. So, but it's too late for that now. We messed up already, man. We are monkey slinging poo tonight. This is going to be fun. This is going to be fun. I am so excited about this year. If you guys knew what I knew about the guests we have lined up for this year, you would plot. And I don't even know what that means. So all I do know is we are here to moon the woo-pie. That's what we're going to do. Jezzy, we also had our first Chote Road of the Year that came up, didn't we?
Yes,
on Friday, our first Chote Road of the Year. And you know what I just did? Within 3 minutes of this brand new year, I already did a Chote Road whore. Already whored our own site. I'm on a roll. I'm happy about this. I'm excited. Jezzy, what do we have Friday on Chote Road?
We have our brand new Spotlight Scribe of the Year, which is none other than Scott Christian Carr.
That's one of those Hiram Grange guys, Hiram Grange or whatever, from Shroud.
Right, right, right.
He's one of those guys. It's they got a whole flock of those books coming out, and he's one of those writers. His story is awesome. It's a very cool story if you get a chance to swing by and read it. And a little bird told me, too, that the Hiram Grange series from Shroud, they've been doing so well. I think Tim Deal commissioned like another 137 of them. Whole series of books. Amazing. It'll be like Harry Potter, you know. It'll be like, you know, Hiram Grange and the Unclean Touch, you know, things like that. So, but what else? We know what we've got. I do know this for Chote Road. We signed up two new young, talented people to come party with us this year on Chote Road. We signed them up as Chote Road writers, so we've added to our family. We've got Miriam Davies. She's nuts. That woman's nuts. So we had to have her. So she's on a Chote Road this year, and the dude who's got the new thing up for us, doesn't he?
Yes, in fact.
We'll toss it out there. Don't tease. Let them know.
We have a new feature now on the site, written by none other than W.D. Prescott, and it's an article, and the page can be found at Prescott's Pulpit.
Prescott's Pulpit. Pretty Boy Prescott. So, yeah, he's going to be helping us out. He's going to give us a half dozen or so articles throughout the year that... you know, little tidbits and little fun facts about the genre. So it's about time Chote got serious. You know, we've been jerking around too long. It's time we take our bitness serious. And hopefully Will's going to help us do that because Lordy knows we need it. And Mark Jackson, he's going to be doing his interviews, so that's going to be flip-flopping back and forth. That's going to be cool. But speaking of taking care of bitness, We got a couple things we got to talk about real quick, because I can't wait to get into the show tonight. When you if you just wandered in blind tonight and had no idea what we're doing for our first show back, I can't even work up a fangirl scream. I'm going to try to before the night's over. But you know who we have? Robert McCammon. But don't tell him yet, because I don't think he knows. So we got to take care of some bitness. One thing I have to mention is that we did the Spotlight Scribe of the Year on Choate Road. Every month, like we just mentioned with Scott Christian Carr, we put up a talent we really enjoy, give them the month and a full spotlight and a big neon sign and put up their fiction, and you get a sample of their stories and find out their bios and all that kind of fun stuff. At the end of the year, we do the Spotlight Scribe of the Year. I'm about to announce to you, we had an incredible amount. Well, actually 12. It's not an incredible amount. But an incredible amount of talent that was in our running last year for Spotlight Scribe of the Year. And our winner, are you ready? Jazz, can you do a drum roll or something?
Only in my head.
Okay, put your head up to the phone and do the best you can. But our Spotlight Scribe of the Year, by popular vote, was none other than The Dunwoody. Congratulations, The. You did it, dude. It was a tight race. There was a lot of really good scribes we had last year. But the Dunwoody got the popular vote. And David Dunwoody, you have done it again, sir. I think actually he was our August, which is kind of our birthday on Choate Road. He was nice enough to jump in and be our August scribe. So congratulations to you, Dunwoody. Also, what we did right over the holidays, right after Christmas and New Year's, whatever, we ran a cool thing for you guys. We announced that according to the hit counters and all those kind of fun stats we get for the show, the top three shows last year were Brian Keene, Joe Lansdale, and a wild dude named Kevin Lucia. Kevin Lucia came in third. We announced that. But then we let you guys have fun over the holidays, and we let you guys vote by listening to the shows in the archives. We did the hit counters again, knocked them all back down to zero, started counting again to see who you guys voted in as your favorite show last year. And I got to tell you, it was pretty cool. There were some people I wasn't expecting, and some dark horses, so to speak. Maybe even some dark scribes, black quill people, you know what I'm talking about, that were up in the running. Pretty cool. But in the end, it was neck and neck. And literally, by three votes, he did it again. I don't know how he does it. It must be his boy band charm. But Kevin Lucia was voted by you guys as the favorite show from last year, barely beating out Skull Vines, our Thanksgiving special with the boys from Skull Vines. So that's just some sick, twisted stuff. I don't know how else to describe that. But Vince Lagano was in there. Liquid Imagination, you guys did a really good showing. There were quite a few. And, of course, you know, Mr. Keene and Mr. Lansdale were definitely in there. But you guys voted Kevin Lucia, so very happy for that. He's just all over the place. He's a force of nature. Not even a force to be reckoned with. A force of nature. That's what I think of him. And the chicks dig him. That's important. I think he got the chick vote. And by that, I actually mean poultry. So, and then finally, I'm just going to do a little bit of whoring myself. I'm going to toss this out there. I usually don't push these kind of things, but those Predators and Editors polls are out there, the P&E polls, they're very popular. We were lucky enough last year, Choate Road finished in the top 10. Number one horror site, but we finished in the top 10 overall. So that's cool. But this year, I got to toss it out because there's an evil soul out there, and I know who did it. And I'm looking at you right now. Hold up your phone because I'm looking at you, looking at me, looking at you. Somebody, as many of you guys know, I ran a paranormal romance story called Dracula's Winky, my answer to paranormal romance, last year on Choate Road. And somebody nominated for best romantic short story. Not even in a horror genre or anything. Put it in best romantic short story. So I think we've got until this Thursday or Friday to vote for it. I got to whore it. I got to whore. If you get the chance, let's take our guys back. You know, romance took our vampires and our werewolves and turned them into prom dates and bare-chested Indian dudes that look hunky in the woods. Let's grab it back and let's give a good showing for Dracula's Winky under a romantic short story. That would tickle my fancy like you wouldn't believe. That would pat the ready bum. So, I'm just about out of breath with that, Jez. You ready to take over from here?
Sure.
Good. Well, I got to do this because I just can't hold on any longer. This is, you know, you sit here and you do the show, and you get geeked every week because you have fun guests and you do, you know, you get to jump around for 90 minutes and be a fool. And then we were blessed last year that we had quite a few just big-time writers that just knocked the wind out of you. And to know that we get to start off 2010 continuing that streak. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we have one of the most, to put it bluntly, one of the most influential, and in my opinion, one of the most important writers of contemporary times, a guy that I'm just more than honored to have on the show tonight, and it's going to be a good one. This is going to be fun. I've gotten the honor of chatting with him yesterday, and between laughing our butts off, I think he got his butt back. I'll ask him. Mine came back pretty soon, but we laughed our butts off at the time. What a really cool dude and insightful and talented beyond belief. Ladies and gentlemen, can we welcome to our show Mr. Robert McCammon? Are you with us?
I'm mesmerized by this conversation. I'm trying to get my breath. I'm just listening to your conversation. It's like, wow, I'm knocked out. I'm trying to get recovered from all this. Great. I'm just listening. I'm just hanging in there.
Oh, really? No, you're doing fine. Oh my gosh, are you kidding? and the wonderful thing is, I actually have no idea what I've been blathering about for the past 10 minutes.
Well, I don't either, but it sounded great.
So, how are you, sir?
Good. How are you?
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. You made it through the holidays?
Yep. How about you?
One piece, man. One piece.
And
when I counted everybody, when it was all said and done, you know, the whole family was still here, so
right?
You can't complain.
Good. Very good. Me too. And I did get my ass back.
You did get your ass back.
Yeah.
Good.
I'm
good
on it. I've got it right now.
So, now I will say that traditionally, the werepig is a no pant zone.
Oh, really?
Our big claim to fame is that people found out pretty early on that it's just something I do. I don't usually wear pants during the show.
Okay.
I'm just more comfortable that way. And then guests started jumping into it and whatever.
Okay.
So we're going to have to figure out something maybe different for 2010.
Okay.
Not put that pressure on you guys.
Right.
I don't know. I might do that in a backwards baseball cap. I understand that looks pretty
okay.
cool.
Okay.
Sure.
Whatever
makes you feel good, sir.
Whatever works.
You know, but, by the way, congrats real quick on your national championship.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Appreciate that. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was, for those who don't know, Mr. McCammon is from the great state of Alabama.
Yep, Birmingham, Alabama, right.
And you guys stomped in the number one college team.
Yeah, pretty good game. Thank you.
And I actually tuned in because I'm not a huge college football follower.
Yeah.
But you know, you got to see number one and number two play. You guys played the Texas Longhorns,
right.
And they had this guy named Colt McCoy.
Right.
And we actually have a friend of ours that always drops by the show, runs a magazine called Necrotic Tissue, and his name's Scott McCoy. And I was fascinated because I'm one of the few people that knows that he uses the name Colt McCoy when he does foreign films. If
oh,
you know
really?
What I mean.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
it wasn't him. I thought, well, he also plays quarterback? No, it wasn't him.
Right. Well, you know, I'm sorry he was injured. I'm sorry Colt McCoy was injured. In fact,
yeah.
I haven't heard anything about his status. You know, I don't know how.
Yeah, they were pretty quiet on it.
Yeah.
He got a shot in the shoulder, and then that was it. He just kind of got up and walked out.
So, but you know, it didn't look like a hard shot. It didn't look like a serious shot, but evidently it was a pretty serious shot, and they're being pretty quiet about it right now. So.
Yeah, he's an incredible talent, equally, our Colt McCoy in those films quite
is,
a talent too.
Is equally the talent, huh?
Yeah. So I didn't want to let him slide by without giving him kudos.
And if your Colt McCoy gets injured, I imagine, and he's put out of action, that's a really serious injury, right? I mean,
yeah,
an unmentionable injury.
Yeah, he'll be walking with a limp for a while.
Okay. Okay, gotcha.
So, but no, congratulations anyway, though. And,
thank you.
We have. We
as
have
if
so
I had
much...
something to do with it. As
well,
as
you
if
did.
I had something to do with it, right?
Oh,
thanks a lot.
I'll take pride in it. My Baltimore. I'm from. Grew up in Baltimore. My Baltimore Ravens won today against the New England Patriots.
Okay, good.
I'm walking around the house with my chest out all day. Just,
cool. Great.
You know, as if you know, I scored all the touchdowns, made all the tackles.
And why? And why are they called the Ravens?
Because we are a huge part of Edgar Allan Poe's history.
That's right. Absolutely. How about that?
In fact, he's buried here.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, not here. I'm actually in Pennsylvania now, but he's actually buried in Baltimore.
Baltimore, right, right.
So,
can you imagine what he would have thought if he would consider that his an image that he conjured up is now the name of a professional football team?
Yeah,
you know,
one of his biggest legacies. Yeah, is a black-birded mascot running him down the sidelines. I'm sure he'd take a lot of pride in that.
Who would have thunk it? But there you go.
So maybe, just maybe, one day in the distant future, Alabama could get a team and name it after you.
Oh, you think? You think
that'll
ever happen?
They did it with Edgar Allan Poe.
Don't think that'll ever, 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 ever happen. Well, that would be cool, but ain't going to happen.
Well, that'd be cool. It's and Lord knows with all the characters you've created.
Yeah,
we could find something fun.
We definitely could find something fun, something that the Tide could use as a mascot. No, but we could find something fun.
So, well, like I said, there's a ton of stuff I want to cover.
Because
your books are they're just at a different level. They really are. I mean, it's you'd be surprised, or maybe not. I don't know. Maybe you hear this quite often from the fans. But I know within the horror circles we all run around, you get mentioned constantly as one of the major dudes that set us on our current path as trying to also be writers.
Well, that's great. I mean, I hear that occasionally. I enough to make me feel good about it. But you know, it's it's amazing to hear that. I mean, it's not like I hear it every day, but it is amazing to hear that.
Well, it's there's just some whatever it is you tap into when you write your books, it must just be a wonderful, magical place you go to.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, I enjoy what I do. I've always enjoyed what I do. That's the number one thing. And the number one thing also is when I write, I always write for myself first because it's a book, it's a story that I want to read and a book I want to read. So it's it's fun for me.
Is that a key factor in writing? Because I do actually hear a lot of great writers say that over and over again. Write for yourself.
Yeah, I think that absolutely, because I think if you have to write for yourself because, you know, you're going to be the first reader. Of course, you're going to be the first critic. And, you know, you're hoping and intending that other people get pleasure from what you're doing, but the number one critic and number one reader really has to be you.
No, I can definitely see that. It's now, do you ever argue with yourself? Do you ever sit down and write something and go, oh, this is great. Oh, no, it's not.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Now, not like that, but it would be like, you know, I think this is going well. I think this is going pretty well, and I like this. Then the next day you come back to it, and it's like, no, in the light of day, no, this is not really what I want. And at some point, you know, you say, well, you know, the words are not right, you know, and I can't find the right words to describe this or – and so you do argue with yourself in a way, not verbally, you know, but you really do because and it's not second guessing yourself, but it's making sure that you're doing the right thing and you're challenging yourself to do the right thing.
I often actually do argue with myself aloud. Is that wrong?
Is that wrong? Well, maybe not for you.
Do I need help? Is there a pill I should be taking?
A pill? Is there a pill to be taken? There probably is. But, you know, maybe for you, it may be the right thing.
Now, do you have you've been doing this for quite a while. I mean, you go back a little ways with your writing from when your first book came out.
I've been a full-time writer since about 70, I want to say 77, 78.
Holy crap,
a
really?
A long time, that's right. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I well, for instance, and I don't want to retread on too much territory because I know, you know, you get interviewed a lot, and I know as often happens, you know, you get the same 100 questions over and over again. But I did find it funny when I was going through some of the research and looking up, you know, something like Swan Song,
mm-hmm.
which you're, you know, one of your greatest books, and everybody knows you for it, and New York Times bestseller and whatever. And I was looking at it, and I noticed that it came out in 87.
It was 87, yeah.
87, New York Times bestseller. And I thought that was funny because that's the year I was born.
Oh, come on. Wait a minute. Wait. Okay.
Yeah, maybe not. I don't know, somewhere
okay.
in there. It gets foggy.
Foggy, but, yeah, okay. Well, on this end, too. It gets very foggy on this end, too. Because it's so funny, you know, an interesting thing is that somebody will come up to me and say, well, you know, this character that you wrote about and say in Usher's Passing, this is so good. And you know, I've done so much since then or since the earlier books, I can't remember. It's like, you know, oh, thank you so much. It's like, thank you. I, you know, and it'll be a scene or something that I've done, and I've forgotten it because as you go on, as you're writing, as things are foremost in your mind, these older books begin to fade away, and it's, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I remember that, but I really don't, you know. So that can be kind of weird.
Well, I know
it's like
that
it's like in a way they're talking about somebody else's work at that point. You know, it's like, oh, I remember doing that kind of, but not really, you know.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty wild.
Yeah, and because a lot of it, I can go back and read and say, yeah, I don't remember doing this. I don't remember writing this because it's weird. Because for me, I when I'm really really working hard, it's almost like a and I won't say trance state because that gives you a that makes you think of something that is not. But it is you're almost in an alternative world. You're in your own world really. You know,
mm-hmm.
because everything is so focused. Or at least I am just so focused on what I'm doing that. Everything goes.
Well, yeah, you hope you get into some kind of zone or
you
whatever you want to call
zone,
it. You know?
And everything goes away, and really the real world goes away. And I work at night. I work from about 10 at night till well early in the morning. I mean, I can work all night, some nights, most nights all night, and the world becomes a foreign place. You know, your world becomes the office and the place you're working in, and it becomes. What you're working on, the world you're creating, and the real world ceases to exist. So it becomes a weird deal. Especially as I'm finishing a book, it becomes much more intense.
Now, is that actually your best work hours?
Yeah.
From 10 o'clock at night on?
Yes, right.
Kind of
right.
The world shuts down, phones stop ringing.
It's quiet, and I've always enjoyed working at night. And I'm a night person anyway, so that just works out that way.
That's pretty cool. That was going to be one of my questions to you, was trying to find out what your pattern was, because we love talking about that topic on the show, because everyone has their own,
sure.
you know, whatever, and sometimes it's less regimented than others. Sometimes, you know, a lot of us just kind of,
Well,
you know,
as a kid, I mean, I was listening, reading, staying up late at night, and I just gravitated toward that. As a kid, I listened to radio late at night, WLS in Chicago, listened, you know, late at night and as a teenager. And I just gravitated toward night for some reason. I really liked it. And that's just me.
Oh, I'm the same way. I have a long history of doing stand-up entertainment, all that kind of stuff and whatever. And I've always loved the night much more. And then there were two little human beings who came into my life that said, no, you need to still wake up 6 o'clock in the morning and take care of business.
Yeah.
Evil, evil little people in my life.
Yeah, but that does happen. Right.
So,
you do what you can. And like I say, those are the best hours for me. When I'm finishing up a book now, I'll start almost double timing it, and I'll work all night, and then I'll sleep for a few hours and get back to the book, and I may work, you know, day and night, the final few weeks, but it becomes very intense. That's why I say, you know, I say it's a great life. I love being a writer, and you know, because when it's going well, it's the best feeling that you can possibly have is creating when it's going well. But when it's not going well, it can be the worst possible thing because no one can help you. No one can help you. You are entirely on your own.
Yeah.
No one can help. You know, you can't take a problem. to your wife and say, help me, you know, because really she can't. She can't, because she can't see it like you can. No one in the world can see it like you can. So you're really alone with it. And it is sort of a life of a hermit, at least for me it is. And like I say, it can be the best, and it also can be the worst.
It's nice that you get to call your own hours, and it's nice you get to take your own lunch breaks and,
yeah,
and
that's right.
Things like that, and take the trip down to the mailbox to, you know, get paid that week or whatever.
One major part of this has always been for me. It's been freedom for me. Is that I find freedom in my work, and that has always been much more important than money to me, than really anything. Freedom to do what I want to do, and the way I want to do it, is the most important thing for me.
Have you ever been a 9-to-5-er?
Briefly. And I was, when I wanted to be a journalist, because I always enjoyed writing as a kid. And I thought, well, you know, what can I do to write, you know, as a profession? And, well, the obvious answer would be to be a journalist, work with a newspaper. So that was really my plan. And so when I finished college, I was going to be a journalist, but I couldn't get a job at a paper. And so I got a job at a department store in their advertising department. That was a 9-to-5 job. And then after that, I got a job at a newspaper, and that was a nighttime job because I was working on the copy desk and I was doing headlines on the copy desk. But at the same time, during the day, I was going out and doing feature stories and trying to get these stories published in the newspaper. But they had their own crew of people, of course, who were doing reporting and doing feature stories. And they had a guy there who was like the city editor. And I had this list of ideas I wanted to do for feature stories. And he said to me, I turned to him in this list of story ideas. And he said, Rick, as long as I'm city editor of this newspaper, you will never write for this newspaper because your role is on the copy desk. Your role is writing headlines on the copy desk, and you're not going to move beyond that. And so I realized, you know, here I am.
Ouch.
Yeah, ouch. And so, you know, he's protecting his side of it, and I'm expected to do. I'm not going to move. You know, I'm not going to be able to do what I want to do. So that's when I wrote my first book. I thought, you know, I've got to do something to get out of this dead-end situation. So that's when I wrote my first book. And I was amazed, you know, when my first book sold, because it was the first book I'd ever written. And that was, I guess, 77 or so. The first book I'd ever written sold. And so I was kind of on my way.
Do you still
spend
Christmas?
Give up my job. I didn't give up my job, though. I kept the job until I'd written, I think, my third book. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, No. Did you ever send your former boss a Christmas? Do you still send him Christmas cards for the fact that
no.
His bullying pushed you to write your books?
But you know, that's right. He did push me. You know, and you could look at that in two ways. You could look at that as being, this guy stood in your way. He kept you from doing this. But it gave me the incentive to sit down and write. So it's really a double-edged thing there, you know. Yeah, I really should thank him for that, shouldn't I?
You could be working on a local Alabama paper right now.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. That's exactly right.
So, I have seen, looking all over the place, you know, for information on you, you're everywhere. I mean, there are like, YouTube videos of people in France, in Spain and stuff, celebrating your book.
Well... I haven't seen that.
Oh, it's crazy.
Really?
There's,
okay.
Yeah, there's somebody was doing a giant promotion. I think it was maybe it was in Spain.
Oh yeah.
And they had a whole little promotional thing with coffins coming down the street. Whatever it was.
Oh, the coffin. Yeah. Oh yeah. I know what you're talking about. The coffin going down the street. Yeah. Right. Right. How about
that's
that?
That's got to be pretty awesome when you sit back and look at this and say.
You know, the deal is, though, the way I think about myself is I think about I'm a guy who has always enjoyed reading and writing. And I thank God, and I'm so blessed I'm able to write. And everything else is that's come along has just been added, you know, because my thing is I'm able to create and able to have the freedom that I want to have. And that's what's the most important thing to me. And everything else is just you know, extra added.
Now, we did chat a little bit about this yesterday.
Yeah.
But speaking of freedom,
yeah.
You know what we'll do? Here's what we'll do between you and I.
Yeah.
Let's make a safe word.
A safe word, okay.
A safe word. That if I ask too far or ask a question
that goes too far. Don't worry. You won't ask too far, because I think if I'm here talking to you, we should talk about whatever you want to talk about, and there should be no safe word, and ask me whatever you want to ask.
Well, I was going to pick, like, you know, Jesse Pumpkinhead.
If you have a really cool safe word.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jesse Pumpkinhead. And
okay.
Even if, you know, I don't care if you don't want to talk about it. I just like to hear you yell that out.
Yeah, right. That's what I figured.
Yeah. So that's.
Okay.
But in talking about freedom, we've kind of, and I might be going too far with this, but there's a little group of us that have kind of termed you more or less like a Johnny Cash figure in fiction. Johnny Cash was kind of known, besides being a great, you know, musical entity, he was known for kind of being his own guy.
Yeah.
When it came to choosing the things that happened with his career.
Yeah.
And he wasn't afraid to throw down with bigger corporations or whatever else, you know, recording companies.
Right.
And say, well, then I'm not playing this game.
Right.
Can we call it a vacation? What should we call it? You had taken decade off at
sure.
one time.
Sure. And, you know, let me start. That's the story off. And, you know, a lot of people know this and some don't. But let me start this off that it started with actually when I finished Boy's Life. When I finished Boy's Life and turned it into Pocketbooks, you know, I was so excited about it. And I thought, you know, they're going to call me from Pocketbooks. They're going to say, Rick, you know, we didn't know you had this in you to write this book. Because I was very excited about Boy's Life when I finished it. And I had the feeling that it was something special. I had the feeling that this was good. So I'm waiting for a call from Pocketbooks. And so I get the call, and the call is, Rick, you know, We don't really understand the book. We think you need to cut out a lot of this, because it really is a book about a murder mystery. You know, it's a story about a murder mystery, and everything else is extraneous. You need to take out all this about about the characters, in the town, and people are going to be confused about that, and just focus on the murder mystery, okay? And so I'm hearing this, and I'm thinking, they don't get it at all, okay? You know,
wow.
Right? Yeah, wow. So they don't get it at all. So I say, well, hold this thought, and I will be there in your office in New York tomorrow. And I flew overnight to New York the next day. And I think everybody was, no one was there to meet me except one guy who was my friend, Adam Rothberg, who was doing public relations, publicity at Pocket now. And now I think he does publicity and public relations for the entire Simon & Schuster group. But anyway, great guy. But so he's there to meet me and kind of calm me down. But anyway, I said, if you guys want to make these changes, I'm breaking my contract. I'm walking out of here, because you're not getting the book. You don't get the book. But anyway, as it worked out, they said, whatever you want to do, Rick, fine, whatever you want to do. So, but I thought, you know, they don't really get me. They don't get the book. They don't get me. So I have one more book to do, Gone South, one more book on the contract. I'm going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to go someplace else. I've got to find someplace else, because they don't get me. So then I did Speaks the Nightbird, and I got a really good offer from Viking. And Viking is a fantastic publishing house. I mean, that's like the temple of publishing. So when I go into there and I talk to an editor at Viking, the editor does not get Speaks the Nightbird at all. I mean, we're like, you know, we're just at cross purposes on this, you know. And she says, for instance, she says, tell me, what is a gittern? And I said, well, it's actually a guitar. And she says, well, just say then, why don't you just say guitar? And I said, well, no, that's not what it was called back then. It's a gittern, G-I-T-T-E-R-N. She says, well, the readers won't care one way or the other. And I thought, now, wait a minute. Now, wait. Now, if you don't care that it's accurate, something's wrong with you. It's a shame. It's a shame if you don't care. It's a crime if I don't care. And so that was our situation there, that she didn't get me, I didn't get her, and she, you know, so we just, that was just not going to work. So anyway, we had some disagreements and about how the book was going to go, and I just was not going to do what she wanted me to do, which is really make it into a romance. It would have been a very light romance, and I just was not going to do it. So
wow.
So I took the book, and you know, and I said, I'll tell you what, let's take this book off the take this book out of consideration. Let me write you another book real quick and see. You know, because I want to keep this relationship with Viking. I want to keep it going. So I wrote another book called The Village. which is a World War II book, and it's set in Russia in World War II. And anyway, there was some bad feelings or whatever. Anyway, they wouldn't even look at the book, and so it was like, you know, it's done, you know. I'm finished, you know. So it's all go home. But I felt good about it that I stood up for myself. That I was not going to let Speaks of the Nightbird become what I did not want it to be. But the deal is, I mean, when you go in to talk to an editor anywhere, Viking anywhere, the deal is if the editor does not get what you're doing and proposes something to you that you know is completely wrong, and you have to say to this person, no, I think this is wrong, instantly you can forget that relationship. Because no editor in New York City wants a writer to come into their office and say, you're wrong. But if you don't say you're wrong, you're going to sit there and watch your creation be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do
that. That's actually, you see that all the time across all facets of entertainment.
Yeah, you do.
You see it with movies. You see it with television. You hear these gigantic compromises that have been made.
Right.
But we actually shot a Christmas special one year. And along the same lines, we shot this Christmas special, and the director we hired him because he was going nuts about it, going, oh, this is kind of the Wizard of Oz, and this and that, and this is beautiful, and this is great. I really love what you did. We hired him, and the first thing he did was rip up the script and say, let's make it a musical.
Oh, yeah, right.
And you kind of just start laughing and say,
right.
Wait, did you even – what happened?
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
You see that all the time. And to have – I mean, to be able to put your career, I don't know, at risk or not, but to be able to put it on hold for an entire decade –
well, you know, I really was.
That's pretty awesome.
I thought I was done. I mean, I thought I was finished, and I thought that this is the end of my writing. And the deal was, I was asked to read at UAB, University of Alabama, Birmingham, to speak to a class, and I wound up reading part of Speaks of Nightbird. There happened to be an editor in the audience from a local publishing house, who said, "Well, what's going on with the book?" And I said, "Nothing." She said, "Well, can we have a shot at it?" And I said, "Sure." So they picked it up in hardback, and then Pocket picked it up in paperback. So that kind of got me back on the track. But that was after, you know, 8 years or so. But I thought that I was finished, you know. And I just like, you know, and people have asked, well, what did you do during all that time? And I say, well, I walked. I did a lot of walking. You know, I did a lot of reading and a lot of just thinking, I guess. But I was determined that, you know, but the deal is, you know, I can understand compromise, and the compromise is necessary. You know, you have to compromise on many things. But the deal is, as a writer, number one, you're doing it, like I say, as a hermit. You're doing it on your own, and you have to really believe strongly in what you're doing. You have to feel like when you take it in, when you finish it, it's as good as it can be. Now, that's not saying it's going to be perfect, but you cannot then give up your child to be destroyed. After you spent so much time creating what you think is the best you can do. Now, that's not saying that it doesn't need to be edited, doesn't need to be compromised in some way, in some positive way, not negative. And I think there can be a positive compromise, and there can be a negative compromise.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can agree with that. I think if people can go into things and say, we used to have a saying, change to make it better is good. Change for ego's sake is bad.
That's right.
You know,
just
have someone kind of, you know, pee on the fence post, so to speak, and say,
sure,
well, this is the change I made.
Sure, sure. And I can say, hey, you know, hey, it's my ego too. But you know, I'm also saying the fact that I've been doing this for a long time. You know, and I kind of do know what I'm doing by now. But that was one of the things that kind of came out of that situation is that you know, are you sure you know how to write anymore? Are you sure are you really sure you know, you still know how to write? And so Speaks of Nightbird was just going to be a one-shot deal. It was not going to be a series. So when Pocket did Speaks of Nightbird in paper, I was thinking, well, you know, maybe I can come back. Maybe I can make a series out of this because I like the character. So maybe I can carry it on. But like I said, it was not going to be a series. It didn't start out to be a series.
Right, right. And where has that gone now?
Well, I'm planning 10 books, and Mr. Slaughter will be out here, in a matter of weeks. That's the next.
That's the third book, isn't it?
Third book in the series, right. So, and I've got them plotted, you know, I know how the series is going to end, I know, you know, how we're going to get there, And in the meantime, I'm going to do some contemporary books in between. So there's a lot going on, and I'm very excited to be here. I was going to say to be back, to be here.
And by that, you mean, of course, the Funky Wear Pig, and I'm blushing already.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
But
I'm glad to be anywhere.
But in the time you took off, you come back now, and now you have the whole, Matthew Corbett series that's really doing well. You have Mr. Slaughter coming up, which everyone's very eager to read. For a guy who just stated that he wasn't sure he could write anymore because of this, you kind of proved yourself wrong, didn't you?
Well,
thankfully.
I wanted to do something different, and that was the challenge, to do something different. I think I wanted to prove to myself that I could do something different. Because, looking back on what I did, I'm not sure I ever really wanted to do a horror novel, per se. I'm not sure I really ever wanted to write a novel that was like, oh, I'm writing this novel to frighten people. I'm writing this novel to gross people out. I'm writing this novel to disturb people. That was never really what I wanted to do. I wanted to tell a story. Now I think I'm interested in supernatural. I'm interested in kind of the weirdness of life. And I think those things came into the books, but it didn't necessarily begin with those things in mind.
With you were saying that a lot of this started with Boy's Life,
right,
which I'm sure I don't know. Hopefully you'll never get tired of hearing it, because I don't think people will stop saying it. One of the most powerful books many of us have ever read. And I'm sure you get a lot of comments about it. I saw a very inspiring video clip of you actually talking before a Florida school board about it, because they were talking about banning it, I guess, because of profanity or something.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you were mentioning the letters not only from adults, but from young kids, 15 and under, that are reading this book it's already their favorite book, and launching them into thinking about being authors and stuff.
Right. Well, that's true. If not launching them into reading, also launching them into wanting to be writers, and that's a great thing. And it's true that the book is amazing to me, that it's affected young people as well as old people. I mean, I got a letter here recently from a person in their 80s in Scotland, as a matter of fact, who said they could really relate to it. So it's been really gratifying in that sense that you've reached so many different ages.
Now, as throwing the Johnny Cash moniker at you again, knowing that all this started with Boy's Life because they didn't understand it and they wanted you to strip it down and switch it around and everything, are you happy you stood by your guns there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because, because absolutely. And it's been tough because, like I say, it's been a torturous journey to come back and be sitting on the sidelines. And if you had an idea, it's like, no, you got that idea, but no, it's not going to happen because you're out. So it's been a torturous journey, but I am very glad I stuck to my guns, because if I had not, who would I be?
Mm-hmm.
I would be pretty much worthless if I hadn't.
And we would have lost Boy's Life.
That's right. Absolutely.
So now I'm dying to ask you this, because I won't dare to do this on the air.
Okay.
You always paint such cool characters, and you're very character driven with what you do. In Mr. Slaughter, what is Mr. Slaughter's first name?
Oh, you want to know how to pronounce it?
I've tried it. I know what it looks like.
Okay. How would you pronounce it?
You're setting me up now.
I'm setting you up. How would you pronounce it?
Well, obviously it looks like Tyrannosaurus Rex kind of thing.
That's exactly right. That's why I chose it.
So
it
Taranthus?
Taranthus, got it.
That's it?
That's it. Taranthus.
What a kick butt name. Taranthus Slaughter.
Yeah.
You love those kind of names. I mean, in all my stories, the villain's name is Judy.
Judy.
And it just doesn't hit as hard,
But it could. It could.
They
know?
Could. And they're not all named Judy because I'm still bitter about the prom. That's not even a consideration.
Okay.
But Taranthus Slaughter. At what point do you sit down and think of a name like that? When does that come to you?
You don't know. And that's one of the weird deals about this, is you don't know where a lot of the stuff comes from. It's like, I obviously wanted him to be monstrous. And so then I had the scene also about they're talking about this thing that was found in a coal mine that acts as a tooth of a monster. And so it began to come together that he needs a monstrous first name, and I began to think of Tyrannosaurus Rex and that Tyrannus, and that just worked out, you know. It just sounded right.
It's awesome. I mean, it's intimidating. It's one of those names that you hear instantly and just go, this isn't going to wind up good.
Thank you. Yeah, right. Right. Thanks.
So, now, one of the other books you have coming up, I actually was somewhat amused about this because you've really done a lot more, you know, since you've been back, you do a lot of the historical colonial type of, you know, period pieces. I mean,
yes.
And you're known for going, you know, let's write about the 50s. Let's write about this. Let's write about that.
Yeah.
And you're really good with time period pieces. You're going to be writing a contemporary book about a rock and roll band, is this right?
The Five. I finished it in October, and it's making the rounds now. So we're hoping things are gonna go well there. But yeah, I finished it, and I'm really excited about it. I think I'm really up on it, and yeah, done with it. Right.
What is it? Give us a quick pitch on it. What I'm trying to picture: Robert McCammon writing a book about a contemporary rock and roll band.
Well, it's about a rock band called the Five, and they're on their last tour, and they're just worn out. They've been ground down, and they're on the last tour. So, on the last tour through the Southwest, from Austin to Hollywood and back again, and so they're breaking up, and they're just trying to keep it together. And so they decide, the leader of the band decides, why don't we do? We've never done this before. We've never all written a song together. All of us, everybody in the band, even if you think you can't write a song or part of a song, everybody writes a part of the song, and we all put it together, and we perform the song at our last show. So that is kind of what it's about, and then there is a force that comes into play that does not want the song to be completed.
Oh.
Yeah, because the song has a meaning and an effect that you don't know until later, but there's something that wants the song to be not finished.
Is it Celine Dion?
No. Ooh. No.
It's Nemo Force, right?
Yes, it is.
So now, is after all the things you've written, and the intense areas you go into, What kicked into gear for this one? What was the calling that made you say contemporary rock band? Was your dad a musical guy? Did I read that correctly?
My dad was a drummer. Yeah.
He
played drums in a band, and I actually never knew him, because my folks divorced pretty early, so I never
gotcha.
I never knew him. I never met him, but he was a drummer in a band. Yes, and and I've always enjoyed doing music myself. I mean, I've always liked music. And as a matter of fact, let me tell you this real quick. I'm thinking about doing a podcast, a 60s music podcast.
Really?
Yeah, I'm thinking about doing that. I'd like to do that because I've got tons of 60s garage rock weird stuff. You would love some of this stuff. So, yeah, 60s, you know, garage stuff that I'm thinking about doing a podcast and doing maybe one a month. And so I'm, you know, I've got tons of those. But you know, I really like, you know, the one hit wonders, you know, the band that did maybe an album and then they went away, you know, and you never heard from them again. That's the kind of thing that appeals to me. But anyway, and I play keyboards a bit, so I've always been interested in music, interested in the business behind music. And also, you know, right now, of course, the music business is on the rocks, and that's kind of interesting to me. How these bands are dealing with that, you know, you know, this disaster, you know, that's going on with the music business.
Who do you listen to, other than, you know, the one hit wonders from the 60s and stuff, you know, Kingsmen, Louie, all that kind of fun garage bands.
Oh man, I mean, really.
Who do you listen to when you have just time to lean back?
Instantly, when you ask me that. So many names came together in my head that there is a mental log jam of names that jammed together. Just when you asked me that, I have to tell you, my daughter gave me the new Lady Gaga for Christmas.
Oh, calm down, Jesse, calm down.
We're listening. Uh oh, she's been very quiet during this. Have you been there?
That's because she's got her headphones on. She's currently listening to Lady Gaga, I guarantee you.
Well, anyway, so I got Lady Gaga. So, you know, really good. I'm enjoying that. I picked up one, The Monsters, today. The Monsters, or a couple days ago, The Monsters. Anyway, a new band. Anyway, when you ask me, all these names clogged together in my head, and I have to run through and think of who I'll listen to, but a lot of different bands, and, you know, a lot of weird bands.
So you actually rock out to people we'd see in the Grammy Awards this coming year or whatever.
Possibly, but usually it's people who they wouldn't let anywhere near the Grammys, you know, off the line. Well, Buckethead, for instance.
What did you call me?
You know Buckethead?
Oh, okay.
You know Buckethead?
No.
You don't know Buckethead, guitarist? Great guitarist, Buckethead. He wears a Kentucky Fried Chicken bucket on his head. Absolutely. He has holes drilled in the, and, you know, cut into the bucket.
Jesse, is he, do you know what he's talking about?
You know Buckethead?
No.
Okay.
I can't say I'm familiar
right.
with that one.
Honestly.
I'll tell you what's happening right now. I guarantee you I know what's happening.
Okay.
Robert McCammon, ladies and gentlemen, is sitting here saying, you know what, I've been talking to this guy for an hour, I'm going to start making up stuff.
Nope, I'm not making it up. I'm telling you.
Let's see if he can pay attention. Buckethead. He wears
Buckethead.
A Kentucky Fried Chicken bucket on his head.
On his head, yes. And you don't.
If this winds up being a character in the Five.
Nope, this is a real guy. He's a fantastic guitarist. Yeah. And the band, I like the band. Well, I like you too, of course. I like Oasis. I think they're great. If they can not kill themselves, the two brothers.
Yeah, that's half the fun with those guys.
Yeah, that's half the fun is watching that fight go on. But, you know, great music, I think. See, if we sit here and keep talking about this, more and more will come to me. But I listen to a lot of music.
No, you.
But as I'm doing my colonial work, I listen to period music.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So do you actually, because I know when I write, and a lot of other people say when they write, you kind of put on different mood music depending
Absolutely.
On what you're writing.
Yes,
do you actually do that?
Yes. Hello?
Hello?
Hello. Gotcha.
Does that work?
Yeah.
Are you still there?
Yeah, I am here. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Good. We're both here. Good. The mood music, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yes, I do. I listen to the mood music, the actual, you know, colonial-type music, yeah.
Cool. For a second there, I thought Buckethead got him.
No, maybe so. Look him up. He's a real guy, I promise.
I guarantee you. Jesse, are you in the party pen? We have a chat room that's always attached to the show that goes up live, and all of our fans jump in there. They're insane. It's an insane asylum, so we call it the party pen. Right now, I guarantee you, half these people are Googling Buckethead.
Okay, and they should. They should find him, right.
They all know who he is, Greg, just not you, that's all.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. That doesn't, you know, it's... but that's pretty awesome. So you do put on different kinds of mood music depending on what you're writing.
Oh, yeah. Right. And it's interesting because as I'm doing the colonial, it's like, you know, I long to listen to rock and roll, but you just can't. You know, when I'm working, you just can't break the mood there.
That must be an intense amount of research you have to do to get the dialogue correct, to get the terminology correct.
Yeah, well, that's one of the
Piece you're in.
And that's one of the reasons with that I had the problem with the situation with Speaks and Iceberg, because the whole deal was we were going to diminish that. And I you know, and even I don't go overboard in terms of, because if I was to really write it accurately, 100% accurately, you probably could not understand the language at all.
Right.
You couldn't relate to the language. You couldn't relate to anything. So you have to be able to write it in such a way that people can relate to it, understand the language, yet it has the proper and correct atmospherics and feel. So. You know, so the problem I have with the Speaks and Opera situation is that this particular person wanted to gut it out of gut a lot of the reality of the era out of it, and so, you know, I completely rebelled against that. But yeah, you do a tremendous amount of research and getting the right language, research on everything and anything and everything, and it's, you know, it's pretty challenging.
Did you find yourself freaking out when you wrote The Five? Because you didn't have to do that?
Well, you know, you have other research to do. You know, you've got other stuff to do. Like, you know, lights, how the light systems, you know, how's the light system set up, you know, how's the stage set up, how's the monitor, you know, what,
right.
what you know, other stuff, you know, what goes on at the sound check, you know, you got to do that right. And so there's always something that you got to research and got to make right.
You do something else that I thought was very interesting. You would, and I'm probably messing up the quote, but in a nutshell, you were saying that you have a tendency to always write bigger manuscripts, you know, 450, 500 pages.
Yeah.
And then you always overshoot, and I guess you scale it back from there. Is that just something you do?
Well,
is
no,
that just
I probably don't scale it back. I probably don't scale it back. It's probably that I just misjudge how long it's going to be. Need to be, you know. I always think it's gonna. I always think, oh, I'm gonna be able to finish this up at about 400 pages. Because sometimes the publisher will say, can you please bring this in at, you know, less than what you've 400 pages, you know, because it's costing us more money to do more paper. And so I always try to, you know, hold it back a bit. But the story just kind of has a life, and that's a cliche too, that the story kind of comes to life on its own. The characters come to life on its own. You hear that? You hear writers say that? And it sounds like a cliche, but it really is the truth. It really is true that the story does take on a life of its own. The characters do take on lives of their own. And so you may be trying to hold the story back, but it's like, uh-uh, not going to be held back. We keep going. And as long as it keeps going, you know, and the story is strong, you keep sort of following it, following the story, following the characters. And they're kind of in charge in a way. And like I say, that does sound like a cliche, but it's really true.
Well, I believe that. I believe that, one of my English professors always said, you know, when is your story finished? When it's done.
That's exactly right. When it's done. Absolutely.
You know, and I guess as the writer, you're the only guy who knows that.
And you're the only guy who knows that. Absolutely. Yeah.
No. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to bring up another a touchy subject, if it's okay. Remember, Jesse Pumpkinhead.
Well, it may not be touchy.
Well, you know, or Jesse Buckethead at this point. I'm flexible.
Now, that would work. Yes.
There was a situation, let's just say, involving not directly you and this gentleman, but the way your careers kind of lashed out together or whatever. You had some problems with critics and Stephen King, something
right.
like that.
Yes, yes. You should finish that out.
Well, it was without saying too much. And I was surprised to find out how much of this is out there, because personally, I mean, I'll go on record saying I thought it was crap. You get compared quite often to Stephen King, don't you?
Yes, I do. And at a point, it was earlier on. It was not in a good way in terms of, because it was like, well, you know. McCammon's ripping King off, and writing. He is copying not necessarily his books, but his ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to get this, and that criticism, you know, was like, and it was insane, because it was like, well, you know, McCammon did Swan Song because King did The Stand, and then he did this because King did such whatever, and it got to be insane, and it really wore me down. And that's really one of the reasons I wanted to do something else and do historical, some sort of historical work, just something different. But it got to be to the insane, and I stopped reading King after, I think, The Dead Zone. Well, I know after The Dead Zone I didn't read anymore, because it was really getting to me, the idea, you know, oh, you know, what, everything I'm doing is, and it was diminishing my own work. It was diminishing my voice and my work. And, for instance, it was getting crazy, because I remember on a forum somebody was saying, you know, this book that McCammon just did called Mine, you know, I read that King had this idea first and that McCammon kind of stole it from him before he had a chance to write it.
wait. So you're getting nailed for things
nailed.
He hadn't even written yet.
Yeah. And somebody said, and another forum, it was like, you know, the werewolf in The Wolf's Hour, didn't it seem an awful lot like this werewolf in The Talisman? You know, and I never read The Talisman. I never even picked it up, looked at it. And so it became, and there were other things too, that whatever I was doing was like, now this is fun. Now this is fun to find these similarities. Or if we don't find these similarities, let's make them up. But if you step back, and you think, what was there that was similar? You know, was it that I actually copied characters? Did I copy language? Did I copy lines from? No. What was similar? And if you step back, you think, there really was nothing similar. But people, some critics, and I don't know what the agenda was or what the deal was, you know, it was.
Mm-hmm.
But it really wore me down, the idea that, you know, we want you to go away. We don't want you around. You know, you're not good enough. You're copying your. But now, let me back up and say a little bit about copying and imitating. When you come into this business, and I came into the business with my first book, I think King had already gotten to be pretty popular. Probably the reason that I came in, and the first book I did was called Baal, and it was about the Antichrist. When I came into the business, probably I wouldn't have gotten into the business had the publishers not been looking for some kind of King, not imitator, but somebody they could say, oh,
right,
this guy's like Stephen King. If you like Stephen King, you'll like this.
Right.
You know? So as it went along, and I'm trying to create my own voice, the publisher is saying, oh, if you like Stephen King, you'll like Robert McCammon. You know, and King is, you know, if you like. So I began to be getting on from both sides, and that, you know, the critics were saying, well, he's copying King, and the publisher were also saying, you know, he's kind of like King. You know, they were saying it too. He's kind of like King, which is not true at all. Not true at all.
So it's like it's a double-edged sword with both going against you. You have critics saying he's copying King, and you've got a publishing company pushing you out there saying,
yeah,
this guy is the next Stephen King or the new Stephen King. Or
you hear, see, I heard that so many times. And it's like, no, shut up. Will you shut up, please? Don't do this. No. But, you know, this is the corporate thing. This is what they see is important. This is, you know, there's value and there's money to be made off this. But for me, it was tearing me up. And you know, there was a newspaper article, and here was my picture, and the headline was, "The man who would be king" over my picture. No, please don't do that.
Oh.
And this just makes people. And King is a Stephen King is a fantastic writer. I mean, he's a just great writer. And you know, but this makes the people who love him and want to protect him as if he needed any protection. I mean, my God, God,
right.
Really. But you know, it makes the critics stand up and say, there will not be any more Stephen King. This guy is not going to be this guy, you know. So you really start taking it on the chin and taking it, you know, getting kicked everywhere. So,
You've never had any. It's never been between you and Stephen King personally. It's always
been the
critics and the idiots
not.
Who are just trying to regurgitate something easy to sell.
Absolutely not. And you know, it's and you know when. After I did Boy's Life, there was a review in the Washington Post about Boy's Life, and it's written by a person named Michelle Slung, S-L-U-N-G. And I've never met the person before, you know, but I think she's a writer, and she's done, I think she's done a book of erotic horror stories, I believe. But she's done, you know, a few things, but I don't think I've ever met her. But anyway, the review of the book was not really about the book. It was about me. It was in the Washington Post. Now this talks about how I am a sleazy, smarmy high school SGA president type. That and the other. You know, and it doesn't really say anything about the book, but it attacks me. And I've never met the person before. But now this is in the Washington Post for everybody in the country to see. Okay, so what did I do? I still can't figure out what I did. The thing that I wanted to do was I wanted to write the best possible book I could. I wanted to find my own voice, and I wanted to be my own person, and I wanted to stand up for what I believed. What did I do? I can't figure that out. But I made some people very angry, obviously. And I would go
and read her erotic collection.
Yes.
And see how many times she drops the name Robert in there.
You think?
That's what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm thinking. Or Buckethead, one or the other.
Or Buckethead, absolutely.
Yeah.
Could be one
of the two, but I mean, damn, dude, that's pretty harsh because it's and you see it once again in all media forms when
yes, you do.
Somebody has a new movie come out and they do an expose for a half hour about how much they hate that person, and it's like, well, what does that got to do with their movie?
Right, Right. And, you know, you just don't understand it. You know, you think what it ought to be about is it ought to be about somebody doing the best they can possibly do. And if you do well, fine. You know, that's what it should be about. But it's really not just about that.
I remember reading years and years ago Bruce Springsteen, when he first came out in the 70s, he used to run through towns when he'd be touring through those towns
uh-huh.
and tear down the promotional posters.
Because
every poster would say, come see the next Bob Dylan.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And
you know, that's great. See, that's how they sell tickets. I mean, they're trying to sell tickets and just,
yeah.
you know, and I understand that. But then that starts to get in the way of who you are. It starts
yeah.
to get into the in the way of who you of what your voice is and who you are, and so that's another thing you gotta you gotta fight against it.
Well, let's bring up this subject because this is something that we get a lot of writers that listen to the show, and of all levels, and this is a subject I just love talking about because I think it's important.
Okay.
And I don't think anyone can really put a timeline on it.
Uh huh.
We always hear the phrase, finding your voice.
Finding your voice.
I've got some good friends of mine right now that are struggling with the fact that they're good writers, but they haven't settled into their voice yet.
Yeah.
I think you can be a good writer, but not fall into that, you know, yet, where you are distinguished. That is you.
Yeah.
When did this happen for you? When did you get to a point that you knew, this is a Robert McCammon story?
Well, the deal is, I think I always like to read, and to read involved stories with a lot of characters, and I think, you know, I think I can look at the progression of my work and say, well, the first books were okay, they were okay, but then, you know, I think I'm getting better, I'm trying to get better, and then the books are getting more and more involved as I'm going along. The scope of the books are getting bigger, the plots are getting bigger, there are more characters being involved, and that's what I really enjoy doing, is the big book with a lot of characters. So I think it was a slow process for me to find my voice, and when I say I find my voice, I've not really perfected my voice yet. And as a matter of fact, my voice is somewhat different in the colonial books than it is in the contemporary work. So it's still a process of finding your voice, and maybe say also when you find your voice, you found perfection in a way, or you found not necessarily perfection, but you found the point of your existence as a writer. So maybe it's something that you're always looking to find. It's something you're always looking to perfect, and maybe it's impossible to perfect it. So it's something you're always trying to achieve. Is when you write a book, people without seeing who's written the book, oh yeah, they read the book and they say, oh yeah, well that's I know who wrote that book because I understand that voice. You know, that voice, I understand that voice without even knowing who wrote the book. And I think
right.
that's very difficult to do. But I think that can be a lifelong quest, I think. You know, what I think I'm trying to say is that can be a lifelong quest for a writer.
And you don't feel that after all the stuff you've done, all the great pieces of literature and whatever, that's kind of cool for me to hear that you still don't think maybe you have found your voice 100%.
You know, I think I found my style. But you know, I think I've written some. You know, I think sometimes you know I have a long way to go in terms of what I want to do as a writer, to communicate to people. Because sometimes even words is like words get in the way. You know, words are you can't find the right word, and there's not a right word. There's not a right word for what you want to say. But you have to work with what you have. You know, I think I've written some good things, but you know, sometimes I look back on things I've written and I can't bear to look at it because I think, oh, I would do this so differently now. You know, I would do it completely differently now. So it's always a struggle to try to get better, I think. And maybe if you ever reach the point where you say, oh, this is perfect. You know, my voice is my voice is perfect now. It's you know, everything is then maybe it's like, you know, well, you're done.
I like that. Where, yeah, I can see that. Where, you know, what else is there to do then?
Yeah, what else is there to do? Because it is about challenging yourself as a writer. It's about challenging yourself and pushing yourself. So maybe if you ever reach the point where you're completely satisfied with something, it's like, well, you know, I think if I ever reached a point where where I was completely satisfied with myself, I'd say something is really, really wrong. You know, something is wrong here. You know, because I'm not satisfied. I think I've written some pretty good things, and I think I've written some really, really good paragraphs and some good lines, but I've not really written yet the book that I think is the perfect book. And you know, and maybe I never will. And maybe it's best that I never will.
Okay, well, let me move it down a peg or two,
mm-hmm.
and ask this. At what point did you reach a comfort zone, I guess, as a writer, where you knew, I can do this, and I can actually write books that sell, and I am a writer, I can do this?
I guess that was fairly early on, even though the first few books I wrote were writing in public. You know, I was trying to learn how to write and write in public, and I had no trunk novels. But I think just being accepted by a publisher and being paid, you know, some money and thinking, well, I'm being paid some money for this, so obviously I've got some kind of readers, and then getting response from readers, getting mail from readers, you think, you know, I can do this. And it particularly, I guess, as it went on, I began to get letters from people who were saying, your books mean a lot to me. They mean something to me. You know, and I want to go back and reread. And that's a big deal. When somebody says they want to go back and reread a book, you feel that's the best of all. I mean, that's fantastic, a fantastic feeling when someone says they want to go back and reread because they miss the book. They got something from the book, but they think, maybe I didn't get everything from the book, and maybe I need to reread it again because I'll get something different from the book this time. Or I like the character so much that I want to go back and revisit and stay with the characters some more and connect with them some more. And that's the most wonderful thing. So when that began to happen, I thought, I can do this.
I like the something you said about Boy's Life, and not to just keep picking, you know, the same books over and over again, but I think it goes over a universal feeling. I just happened to pertain to that particular book, in that going back to the school board thing where they were going to ban it for whatever reason,
right.
They were saying that it wasn't a proper book for young people.
Right.
And you had made the comment that you didn't write it for teenagers, but it was the adults who read it that passed it on to their kids.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was not written for a young audience. But, yeah, adults did pass it on to their kids. And I got many letters and many comments from adults who said and parents who said, you know, I've been trying to get my son or daughter to read for years, and they didn't like anything until, you know, I suggested this book, and they picked it up, and they started reading it, and they liked it. So, you know, I feel really blessed to be able to be involved in that, in helping or turning younger readers on to reading anything, you know. So that's a good thing for me. Makes me feel good.
Now this is one that's going to get fans maybe a little. You know, we'll see what the reaction is. But
okay.
I'm going to toss this out there.
Okay.
I could be wrong too, because a lot of times when I do my research, I misspell words or I just make up things.
Okay.
You know, just for fun.
Yeah.
But I read something that said. Let me just go ahead and read what is written here.
Okay.
And then we'll see how it goes. McCammon now refuses to let his first four novels be republished. It's not that he dislikes the books. He does not feel that they are up to the standards of his later works. Basically it's saying that you are not republishing your first four novels. Are they all bye-bye?
Well, you know, they are not. They're okay, and this is a difficult situation because I know there are people who really like those books, you know, and those books have fans. But for me, I've gone on someplace else, and you know, I just again, it's me more than anything, because when I look back on some of these books, I want to cringe because I think how I would do that differently now. And I mean, I look back on Speaks of Nightbird and cringe in a way, because I think how I would do something different now. And I have to say, I can look back at Queen of Bedlam and say, I would do something different now. So I am extremely self-critical. That's the number one thing. I'm really probably too self-critical, because if I find a mistake in a book, I drive myself crazy and just beat myself about it. So when I look back at these older books, you know, and I see all these things that I would have changed and made different now, it impacts me in a way that I really can't explain it. It doesn't make me feel very good about my work. Though, like I say, I know there are people who like those books and have enjoyed them, but, you know, thank you for putting me in a big corner.
You could have yelled Jazzy Pumpkinhead at any time.
Big corner and dead end and nowhere to go there.
You could have. I warned you.
Well, okay.
But I know that, you know, you have incredibly loyal and just fans who adore your work. And we actually have a couple I see that are calling in. They've been patiently waiting to talk to you. Though I guarantee you, and I think I warned you about this yesterday, there were scads and scads of people that were so excited you were coming on the show. And I said, well, are you going to call in and ask a question? Oh, no. Yeah, they couldn't. And I guarantee you, if I click on at least two of these people, they're going to be sounding like a Beaker from the Muppets. They're just going to be going, yee-yee-yee. I mean, they're not going to know what to say to you.
Well,
but these are the people that love your books, and to know that there's a possibility you might take them off the shelf, you know, you're a heartbreaker.
We may do a box set sometime. How about that? We may do a
okay.
Box set,
there you go.
We may do them upright, but see, I don't believe in going back and redoing anything. I believe in letting it. Whatever you did then is what you did, and don't go back and change it. It is what it is.
So, so you would just rather let them stand alone as opposed to let them sit on a shelf for 10 years and like do the Disney thing where you reissue it.
I wouldn't want to go back and rewrite them, even though I see things that I would change now and do differently. If I was going to do the book at all, you know, you know, the box set thing idea that may happen at some point. But the deal is, you know, my thing is that even though we've been talking about the past here and the things that happened in the past and reissues of books and things, I don't really look back that much. Even though it sounds from our conversation that I do, you know, I look toward what I'm doing next. I look toward continuing the series. I look toward the five. And I'm very excited about that. I mean, I think I'm so glad that I did my body of work and everything, and I'm so glad people enjoy my work, and I hope they continue to enjoy my work. But my focus is on the future. I look ahead.
That's awesome. That's well, and we hope you keep doing that because there's we want more.
Thank you. Well, I have a lot planned, and I have a lot of I think pretty good things planned. You know, like I say, I don't know if I'll ever get to that perfection that I'm trying to get to, or you know, I hope I'll get better and better. I know I'll continue to challenge myself, and that sounds like a cliche too, but it actually is true, because there is a point where you get into something and you say, oh man, I'm not sure I can do this or not, and you say, no, yes, you can do this. And I guess that's what we talked about earlier about talking to yourself. You say, maybe I can't, maybe I really can't do this. Maybe I should put this aside because I really can't do this. And then you sit and you think about it. Now, how do you, you know, you do it by steps. You do it little by little, and then you overcome whatever it is that's bothering you or you know, giving you a problem. And so anyway, that's where I am.
Well, I like that you're challenging yourself. I hope you never stop. But I wish you would stop doing things that are just flat out crazy.
Crazy?
Yeah. For instance, correct me if I'm wrong. I was talking to Hunter,
your
agent, and he was telling me that you just went out for a book signing out to like Ann Arbor in Troy, Michigan. In January?
That is coming up.
That's coming up? You're going out. You know, this is like January, February. This is winter. Have you ever been to Michigan in winter?
Look, you know what it is in Birmingham tonight? 19 degrees.
You know? Is it really?
Yeah, it is. It's 19 degrees.
Oh, my God. This is damn global warming. That's what the problem
is. If it's 19, it's good. I mean, it may be below 19. But, yeah, I'm going to Detroit and Ann Arbor. There's a convention in Detroit that I'm going to. And also it's called the Confusion Convention. Confusion. And anyway, I'm also going to Ann Arbor for actually, that's the kickoff, I think, of Mr. Slaughter.
Well, just be careful, man. I spent 6 long years right in that little town you're talking about.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. My dad actually lived in Troy, Michigan for a long time. And I was telling Hunter where all the little cool restaurants are, and there's a cool comic book store out there if you like comic books.
Oh, good, good.
Great comedy club called the Comedy Castle that's out
okay.
there. But in January, you know, that's crazy talk. That's
yeah.
just crazy talk.
That's how it happened. I mean, that's what the schedule said. You know, here we go. So I'm to expect much snow and much cold, huh?
Like you've never seen.
Like I've never seen.
It's they don't see the sun except for like maybe in June every other year.
Oh, okay.
It's pretty bad. So
okay.
You know, then let's do that. If you're going to be doing this, I live out in, near Harrisburg, York, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Gettysburg. When do you come on out this way? That way, I can have some cocoa ready.
Okay.
Mr. Slaughter takes place in Pennsylvania, doesn't it?
It does. It's in Pennsylvania. And listen, when you get the cocoa ready, will you have a CD of Buckethead there for us to listen to?
I will have Buckethead.
Okay.
I will have Buckethead.
Okay.
In fact, I may have him come with us.
That would be great.
I'm not only just a CD. I'm going to Google search this Buckethead and have him come up and meet us.
Okay.
And why don't we just, you know what would be great for promotions? Always trying to spin these wheels this way. Since Mr. Slaughter takes place in Pennsylvania, let's go on the actual trail that they go on
the
and do a reenactment the whole way.
Sure.
The journey.
Woods.
Let's.
You know, it's woods then. It's probably malls now. You'd probably go through the middle. Of a, you'd probably go through the middle of a mall, don't you think?
Well, whatever it takes.
Yeah, whatever it takes, right?
Whatever it takes.
Yeah.
So let me click in some people here that are probably a little excited.
Okay.
Let's see if we can get them in. Let's see, Mr. McCoy.
Oh man.
Hello.
I did not push the one to say to put me in the queue, man. I can't.
Okay. Well, all right.
Man. I tell you, this is
Colt McCoy, the other one that I was talking about
Colt.
That did the movies. Yeah, that did the movies.
How you doing?
I asked him not to because I don't know what the heck to say, and I don't want to sound like such a fanboy. I'm 43, for God's sakes. But I gotta tell you that I was already a big reader and wanting to be a writer, but very few books have ever moved me like your books have.
Thank you.
I started with Wolf Hour and then, of course, I read them all, read the backlist like I normally do when I find a writer I like.
Thank you.
And then Boy's Life came out, and I didn't know what to expect. And I got to tell you, there's the scene in there when the boy's riding his bicycle.
Yeah.
And his old bicycle, and his bicycle hits that pothole.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember believing that. I had forgotten it, but when I read that, I remembered feeling that way about my bike as a child.
Right. Yeah.
And it's a feeling more than it's a belief, you know, because
right.
I don't think you ever voice it to your friends.
Right.
But when you get on that bike, and I had one hand built, you know, by parts and pieces from my dad, a banana bike, and
sure.
had the ape hangers and the banana seat.
Yeah.
And it just... You can't. It just captured the essence more than I could ever possibly hope to capture as a writer. It just humbled me.
Well, thank you. Well, see, I had the same deal. I mean, I had the bike, and it was like, you know, this is my freedom. This is my motorcycle, the horse, everything, you know, all rolled
yep.
into one. So, yeah, I was right there, too. Yeah, absolutely.
No,
well,
that's
thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. No, it's definitely an honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
And I'm glad you're writing again. I got to tell you, the thing that I was actually infuriated. I hadn't heard you'd been writing again. I hadn't seen it mentioned anywhere. I was walking down the literature section in Barnes and Noble, and
yeah.
I looked down in the M's, and there's I said McCammon. There's got to be another one. So I looked down, and I'm like, McCammon cries the Nightbird. And it had been out a while. I'm like, oh. Oh, I could have read this a year ago.
Yeah, I kind of crept in there, huh? You kind of sneaked back in. Well, nobody was looking, I sneaked back in.
Yeah, back in the old bookstores, but really, honestly, when you were in all the time, there was a horror section, and I knew where McCammon was. I just went right to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now I got to look for it, which is fine. They've done that to a lot of writers, and it's not just horror writers.
Right, sure.
And I definitely understand, and I agree with your perspective about not trying to write this or that and not necessarily being classified or right. wanting to be a horror writer, although I think it's got elements, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's speculative, you know, it's supernatural.
Yeah, sure.
But, yeah.
Well, you know, the deal about the bookstore is it's a tricky situation because, you know, if you're known for something, then, of course, people know where to go look for your books. But then again, if it's a book like the Matthew Corbett series, which is really not, you know, sort of a in betwixt and between, it's a mystery, and sort, you know, where are they going to put that? They don't really know where to put that. They can't really put that in the. Can they put it in the horror section? So if they put it in the horror section, then people who like strictly mysteries may not be able to find it. So it's sort of a tricky situation, you know.
Right, but then there's a certain amount of there's this argument about whether. Genre fiction is literature.
Oh, absolutely.
And,
absolutely right.
And yet now you're definitely in the literature section. You've reached a status of critical acclaim despite some of the idiot critics that just don't have apparently never read any of your work or don't know how to read. But, so being in the literature section, almost it's also a feel-good knowing that it's there.
Yeah, well, for me too. Yeah, it is good to know that it's there, and because that means really that more people will probably pick it up and read it, which is, of course, you know, what I want. But you know, the thing about the critics, though, you know, everybody has their favorite, everybody has their reason for doing what they do, and you know, I don't really hold any grudges or anything against anybody. It just happened. Like I say, I don't look back that much. It's just something that happened. Everybody has their own reasons for liking what they like or not liking what they like.
Looking
for
forward,
I appreciate it.
Looking forward, how much longer before you make the Oprah Book Club?
Well, not probably before Oprah retires and goes away. I don't know about that. I'll keep you posted.
Please do.
Okay.
Please do.
Okay.
So I do have to say we have a few minutes left. Would you please tell people where we can find you, a website, and maybe some dates coming up for Mr. Slaughter, The Five, things like that?
Well, I am at, believe it or not, I'm at robertmccammon.com.
Oh, I'm going to write that down.
How about that? robertmccammon.com, that's my website, and Mr. Slaughter... It comes out, it's released, I think, on the 22nd of January, and I think it's being published by Subterranean Press, and they have a pretty neat website, Subterranean Press website, and doing a beautiful job. It's going to be a beautiful book, so there you have it.
Awesome. Okay. I do have to mention, as far as the Werepig, officially we're back for 2010. We're every Sunday night at 9 o'clock. And next week, we've got a cool lineup coming up, but next week, old friend Dr. Puss is back, and he's bringing a whole slew of his Library of the Living Dead writers that are going to be here. Stephen North and Robert R. Best and Rhiannon Frater, they're all going to be here next week. And after that, we've got D.L. Snell, Gene Rayburn, and Vince Churchill all coming up very soon. So that's 9 o'clock again every Sunday night.
You have Gene Rayburn coming up?
I always throw one in there to see if anyone pays attention.
Gene Rayburn, who used to do the Match Game?
Thanks for calling me out on that. I
okay.
always...
Okay.
Look, it's a little tradition I do.
Okay.
To see if anybody can catch it. I've had Zazu Pitts. I've had Mickey Dolenz. I've had all kinds of people,
okay.
just to see if anyone's paying attention. And you, to start off my new year.
Well, look, I thought if Gene Rayburn was going to show up anywhere now, he would probably show up here.
That's true.
You think?
That's true. Thank you.
Okay.
But you nailed it. Gene Rayburn from Match Game, man. He's a hero.
Oh, he's cool. No. Cool guy, yeah.
So, but thanks so much for being on the show tonight. I mean, it just I just can't believe that I always just am in awe when great talent like yourself decides to come and run around with our silly little show.
Thank you for asking me, and it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
So, and please, folks, Mr. Slaughter, it's coming out soon, and I've read everything that there is to read about it before I get the book. This is going to be fun. Taranthus, is that correct? Did I do that right?
That is it. Taranthus, right.
So make sure you line up for that, and I'm looking forward to the five. That sounds like it's going to be a little different from you.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. Yeah, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Oh, all right. Well, be good, sir. Again, thanks so much for being on the show, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy
Keep
New
it going, year. Please.
I appreciate it. Oh, don't freeze. Too late, but thank you so much.
So, all right, folks, we will see you next week with Dr. Puss, and start just rolling right down the calendar. Let's give a big hand for Mr. Robert McCammon, and those who are piggy petting and out in the party pen. This is if you haven't dove into a lot of the books, you don't know what you're missing. We might not be able to get the first four until the box set.
Okay, there you go.
There's plenty more out where that came from, and I know that I've seen it fired off throughout the chat tonight and different emails I've gotten. You know, make sure you ask about Gone South. Make sure you ask about this one, that one. You know, so. Maybe next time we have another show. Did you know, by the way, that you have your own trivia page?
No, I did not.
You have your it's phenomenal. If you Google search, there's actually a Robert McCammon trivia site.
Really?
That you can sign into. And maybe next time we have you on the show, I'll match you up across from Scott.
Okay.
And we'll read down the questions and see who knows you better.
It won't be me. I've forgotten all this stuff. It will be me. I'll guarantee it.
So, all right. Well, once again, thanks so much,
and
bless you, and just and keep doing that magic you do. And I'm so glad you're back and making us all just smile.
Thanks.
So, be careful out there in Troy.
Oh yeah. Okay.
All right. Good night, sir.
Good night. Take care.
Mm-hmm. What a marvelous, fun gentleman that is. He's such a fun gentleman. And what a way to kick off the new year. I can't say enough about this, that we're just steamrolling right through. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to sign off for now. And I actually was lying about Gene Rayburn, but now I feel guilty. I'm going to see if I can go out and get him. So I'll see what I can do. But we will see you once again, now that we're back from vacation, every Sunday night. 9 p.m. Don't forget to visit www.choateroad.com for all your Chuck E. Cheese of horror pleasure. And until then, keep whoring and horonking, folks. Good night.
Hello?